Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
I'm not coming here for these visits anymore. This is my last time.
I know this is the last time for me, too. I told you that. I ain't going down no more.
You want to keep putting Sophina through this, and you go right ahead. Okay? But Tatiana, that baby doesn't deserve this, Oscar.
She young knows what's going on.
So I guess that's why she asked me why you love taking your vacations more than you like being with her.
Ma, you gotta tell her I love her. Tell her I ain't never gonna
tell
leave
her. Tell her yourself. The next time you call home, you tell her yourself. Or better yet, let her come visit you here.
Yeah, but I don't. She don't need to be exposed.
You already exposed it. You already exposed it to this.
So you gonna leave me? You gonna leave me again? What kind of mom is you? I'm in here by myself.
I love you, Austin.
Man, you don't love nothing.
I do. And I'm praying for you. I'll see you when you get home.
Hey, Ma, hold up. Let me get a hug, Ma.
Grant.
Hey, Ma, I can't get a hug.
Back to the visiting area, Grant.
Hey, Ma, I'm sorry. Ma, I'm sorry. Let me just get a hug, Ma. Ma, let me just get a hug, Ma. Hey, Ma, I'm sorry.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2013 film Fruitvale Station. Written and directed by Ryan Coogler, the film stars Michael B. Jordan, Melanie Diaz, and Octavia Spencer. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Steve Bruns.
Hey, how's it going, Eric?
It's going good. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And it is drink roll call time. So, Mr. Bruns, what do you have for me?
Well, I'm not going too creative tonight. I was troving through my refrigerator and noticed that I had a few Coors Lights left over from a Super Bowl party. So I just cracked open a month-old Coors Light here, and it's by my side, ready to go.
Boo. Boo on the Coors Light. Thanks. Apparently, you must have been expecting Mr. Seabrass to be around for that.
Yeah. Well, we did get together on the Super Bowl. So, yeah.
See, uh-huh. There you go. You got to be prepared for the not-so-classy beer for him. I am going with the Sam Adams Double Agent IPL, which is kind of like an IPA with a little bit of fruit notes in it. And, you know, it's okay. It's not the favorite thing I've ever had from them, but it's not bad.
Did you say something about Agent?
Yeah, it's called Double Agent IPL.
So it's like a themed, like, James Bond
beverage? Yeah, sort of. Sort of. I wish, you know, it would have been cool if they would have done something with the Samuel Adams guy. You know, a little James Bondy, or at least in the pose or something.
It's a coincidence because I just chaperoned a high school dance and the theme of it was Secret Agents.
Oh.
So that's why I like took a double take when you said that.
There you go. It was kismet. Okay, with that, we are ready to begin our discussion on the 2013 film Fruitvale Station.
Fellas, head out to the city.
Why don't you take the train out there? That way you guys can hang out and not have to worry about anything.
Hey, Oscar.
How are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Oscar.
Oscar from Pharmacia?
Get off the train now! Put that phone in there.
Where you at? Are you still on the train?
We still have proof of it.
Why can't you tell me what is going on? What is the problem? What is it? Oh my God.
Good, I'm good. I'm good. We're gonna be good. We're gonna be good.
It's now or never. It's now or never.
And the plot synopsis over at IMDb is as follows. This is the true story of Oscar, a 22-year-old Bay Area resident who wakes up on the morning of December 31st, 2008 and feels something in the air. Not sure what it is, he takes it as a sign to get a head start on his resolutions, being a better son to his mother, whose birthday falls on New Year's Eve, being a better partner to his girlfriend, who he hasn't been completely honest with as of late, and being a better father to T, their beautiful 4-year-old daughter. He starts out well, but as the day goes on, he realizes that change is not going to come easy. He crosses paths with friends, family, and strangers, each exchange showing us that there is more to Oscar than meets the eye. But it would be his final encounter of the day with police officers at the Fruitvale BART station that would shake the Bay Area to its very core and cause the entire nation to be witnesses to the story of Oscar Grant. Now, this is a film that you brought to me. So was this something that you were aware of before the film, or were you just was it on the your Rotten Tomatometer
yeah, I have a system, the Rotten Tomatoes system, I like to call it, and yeah. Basically I just look every week, you know, when new movies come out Thursday or Friday, and this probably came out about a year ago, and I'm getting to it now because I don't know if you're anything like me, but my queue is always at least, you know, three figures deep, you know.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And so this eventually got to the top of my queue. So my guess is it did better than 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. So right. In the fact that it exists, I mean, I don't limit that to even American. I haven't seen so many foreign language films in my life because a lot of like the top French films or the top, like, you know, I saw a Saudi Arabian film last week. Mm. My point being is like some of these like lower radar kind of films that wouldn't be on other people's scopes, I end up seeing them through my system on Rotten Tomatoes. So
nice. Well, there you go. That's also where you get the label of being snooty film wise, right?
Yeah,
I'm right there with you. So
yeah, I've been accused of that once or twice before. Yeah.
So this is a film that I was sort of familiar with. I knew that, you know, I listened to a bunch of best ofs at the end of last year, and this is one that came up a few times, not in a lot of top fives or anything like that, but it was kind of like an honorable mentions or that sort of thing. So I wasn't familiar with the story. You know, being in Nebraska, you don't get a lot of Bay Area coverage.
Yeah.
And so while, you know, it is it's a tragic event, it's not something that really had the reach of Lincoln, Nebraska, I guess, in 2008.
Well, and I'm a journalism high school teacher who reads an obscene amount of news in my life, and I have zero recollection of this when it happened in 2008. And I read a lot of news, so this did, you know, surprise me that I hadn't heard of this either.
Sure. Okay, so at the beginning of the film, like we said, written and directed by Ryan Coogler, and it was his first film. And at the beginning of the film, we have the real footage. We have the videotaped footage from a cell phone or a few cell phones, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that was tough. Like, that was tough for me to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found interesting about it was placed there. So what do you think about the real footage being at the beginning? Because typically I would think that many directors would have your narrative go on, have the end maybe be a bit of a surprise, and then show the real footage after that. So what do you think about that?
Well, it's certainly a style that I've seen in other films. I mean, nothing's coming exactly to mind, but I'm sure with your help you can help me think of one. But doesn't it seem like maybe like one out of every 10 films you watch, like, you know how it's going to end because they show you the ending?
Sure.
But then the journey then becomes, how did we get to that point? And then it flashes back to like 7 days earlier. I mean, I just saw a Robert Redford film called All Is Lost.
Oh, right. Yes.
And you kind of get that same thing where they show you something that happens like 7/8 through the film, and then they take you back 8 days, and then you then find out how he got there. You know?
Yeah, I feel like TV does that a lot.
And
so it's definitely a technique. I guess what I think the difference here was, though, is that it was actual footage.
Right.
And so you
might save the best for last, so I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and so it just – I don't know. Like, I don't know if I would rather have it at the end or not, because it definitely was startling.
Well, to tell you the truth, it didn't really bother me. I wouldn't even have brought it up. So I thought it worked for me. I would just be interested, as somebody who, you know, I like to find out information about things like police brutality when I hear about it. And it just made me wonder, okay, wow, how did he get in that situation? And so it did kind of work for me. I didn't really notice it one way or the other that the director or the, you know, writer decided to go this direction.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess it just struck me as, since it wasn't a documentary, like if it was a documentary, I would have completely.
This is a docudrama in the sense that it's based on true events, but
So I don't know. It was just, it wasn't something that I thought was a negative thing that the film did. It was just something that I was like, oh, well, that's interesting. One of the other things that I found to be particularly interesting, and this is kind of a minor technical thing, but I really, really liked the way that the text messages were shown.
Oh, I love that too. Yeah, that was, you probably had that down in your notes, and I don't really keep notes, but now that you bring it up, and it's been about 3 weeks since I saw the film, yeah, that was a really cool effect.
Yeah, I think that what's nice is it gives kind of a glimpse into his mind, without him saying, hey, I'm thinking this. Mm-hmm. Hey, fellas, now I'm thinking this. You know, it allows the audience to see in the world that we're living at now, where a lot of, you know, a lot of phone conversations don't necessarily happen.
Right.
It gets to see, you know, the way that you portray yourself to other people is interesting. The only thing that I didn't really care for so much, and, you know, this is a scene that kind of irritates me just because I know exactly what they're going for, but it's the sequence with the dog. And he's at the gas station and he's sending another text message and he sees this dog and he's, you know, petting the dog. And it's that, old Hollywood's, you know, cliche for a screenwriter where if you want your main character to be sympathetic and you want the audience to root for them, you have them pet an animal. You have them go out of their way to be nice to an animal because the audience sees that and it's like, oh, what a nice guy. Oh, look how nice he is. Mm-hmm. You know, I identify with him now. And it's the complete opposite for, you know, if you want a character to be a jerk, you have him, like, say something about an animal or kick an animal or do something like that, and it's immediately people are like, oh, that guy sucks. I don't like that guy. So right. In this sequence where he's petting the dog and then the dog gets hit by a car and the car takes off, for me, like, I kind of get what they're doing, but I wonder if that's a little bit much. Like, I was like, ugh. You know, I really like the film. I guess I didn't say that. Like, I really enjoy the film. But that one sequence, I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I don't know if I really need that. Like, that might be a little too obviously pulling at me.
I could see that. And then I guess the next thought I have is, since this is inspired by true events, and to what extent we, you know, don't know, but
sure.
How, if it, you know, if this is supposed to kind of follow a timeline, maybe based on, you know, in-depth, you know, police reports on what he did that day.
Sure, sure.
How would anybody know that event happened? There were no witnesses.
Yeah.
You know, did he tell somebody about it later on, or was it like an artistic license? And if it was, I have to totally side with your observation because, right, I mean, what kind of pathos are we lowering ourselves down that we have to pull up the heartstrings of an audience just to get them to be sympathetic? But if they had some kind of information and this truly did happen, I maybe it's just, you know, part of telling the complete story.
Yeah, that very well could be. You know, he could have gone out later that night and been like, this is fucked up. I saw this dog get hit.
Right, you know, right.
Yada, yada, yada. One of the things that I thought was particularly interesting, given my sort of new situation, is I really appreciated this breakfast sequence where it's the 4-year-old and and the girlfriend, and he's like, they're just all sort of trying to get ready for their day, and it's like, you know, you can identify with this, I'm sure, of having a child and trying to get ready, but trying to get them ready, and they're not necessarily cooperating, and it's just kind of like, you know, it's from the beginning of them trying, him and his girlfriend trying to sort of be a team, but then, you know, the daughter's not necessarily cooperating, and that's something that's, again, just kind of like character building that I really liked, because what I really like about his character is he's not necessarily depicted as this angelic figure. You know, they do show him that he was in jail. They do show him that he's probably cheating on his girlfriend. They don't try to idolize him. They just kind of show him that he's trying his best for, you know, he's trying to make the best out of a situation, but he does and continues to make a lot of mistakes. So I kind of like that.
His ex-boss that morning because mm-hmm. he was trying to get his job back, and then mm-hmm. he like grabbed him, and it's like, whoa, dude. So yeah, I was going to share that as part of my observations, that even though they show the dead dog scene where we're supposed to feel sympathetic, you certainly have plenty of opportunities to see that this guy is no angel, and that he has a lot of flaws, and he probably reaps a lot of what he sows because of his violent nature.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I had written about him as well, was that mm-hmm. I kind of love the aggression that's just barely underneath the skin mm-hmm. that Michael B. Jordan, and how, you know, that's unfortunate. Like, the poor guy being named Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess he may think it's really cool, but I know that this was a film that he was, you know, lauded for. He was also in Chronicle, and now he's kind of, getting a little bit more recognition. I know that he is, he's one of the new, characters in the Fantastic Four reboot coming up. And that was a big controversy because obviously he's an African American actor.
Right.
And he's playing a white character, and oh, how dare you do that with geek culture. And being part of that, that was an embarrassing day for people to lose their mind about something as so silly as that.
Yeah. And the Michael B. Jordan, who plays the main character here, kind of has a special place in my heart as an actor, because I saw him in probably what was one of his first acting gigs. I'm a big fan of The Wire, which was on HBO
sure.
from 2003 to, I think, about 2009. And he played a very emotional situation. Like, he was a character who I believe was assassinated either in the first or second season. And it was to, you know, very non-dry eyes, if you know what I mean. It was it was a tough moment in the show. And he was a really good character. You know, Mr. Seabrass and I are huge Wire fans. And he
was
named Wallace. And that was his name of his character in The Wire. So we oftentimes would talk about what a good storyline that, you know, for whatever he was in for, like I said, one or two seasons, he played an excellent job as Wallace on The Wire.
That's interesting. I don't remember. I mean, I've seen The Wire. I don't remember him in there. I guess I know that I'm due for
it. He looked a lot younger. He was about 14.
Oh, okay. I know that I'm due for a rewatch on it. And
yeah.
Mr. Seabrass reminds
me. It again, yeah, you'll know exactly who it is on the second go around. But yeah, he plays right under, what was his name? Avon Barksdale had a cousin named D'Angelo Barksdale.
Yeah, D'Angelo, sure.
So D'Angelo Barksdale had that, like, you know, courtyard area.
Yeah.
And at the first season, he had three main guys. One was Poot.
Right.
One was his friend, what's his name? Putin, the other guy. He was around for a long time.
Yeah, the two main, I know who you're talking about.
The two, but they had a third guy, and they had to kill him because he had either, you know.
Oh, I know what you're talking about now, yes.
Supposed to do, or he, like, sided with Omar on something.
Omar's coming.
It was Poot that had to kill him.
I got you. Yes, I do remember that. I don't remember that it was him.
Yeah.
I do remember that storyline now. Yeah, so that's good. So I think he's excellent in this. And I expect big things from him. Like, I think that he's really good. I do really like, if someone would have told me that the film was going to be full of a character saying bruh all the time, I'd have been like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how that's going to play, but I think it works well. Like, I think he pulls it off. You know, even though that's, it's kind of silly. Like, I hear a lot of white guys impersonating that. Mm-hmm. And so when he says it sometime, I'm like, oh, okay, but I think it's fine. One of the other things that I really liked was the brother-sister relationship. I think that for as little as we see of it, I think that it's really well done to where he calls and it's like, you know, hey, did you call mom? Yeah, I did. Did you get her a card? No, will you get me one? And don't give me one with any white people on it. And then he gets, of course, the card that has all the old white ladies on it.
Right.
And he's like, oh, I got this one for blah, blah, blah. Just wait till she sees it. You know, and it's just kind of like a little, I got your ass kind of a thing, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, just kind of a little sibling rivalry or sibling sort of, you know, poking at each other that I think is very real and something that I really liked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that worked very well.
Yeah. Something else that I thought that was particularly strong was, you know, we haven't really mentioned her yet, but Octavia Spencer, who's best known from The Help, she plays the mother, and I loved the conversation with the two of them in jail.
Yeah, great acting.
And, you know, it's where you really see that it's not that he's short-tempered or that he has a short fuse. He has no fuse.
Mm-hmm.
He has the kind of heftier white guy say something to him and he blows up immediately. And it doesn't matter that his mother's there and that mm-hmm. he's, you know, having visitation. It's he's, you know, he's just flying off the handle immediately.
Right.
And again, I think that that goes to the whole character building and figuring out who exactly this guy is. And I think that it's important to have those in there because at the end of the film, he's not really like that in the final sort of confrontation.
True. Part of me thinks, and I certainly can see the way that you observe that scene. I kind of had a different take on that scene.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, it was a great scene, and Octavia Spencer, you know, is probably the sole name that anybody would recognize as far as a brand is concerned. But, you know, most films, she would probably be the second or third person listed. But in this film, you know, she's kind of like the all-star, even though she doesn't have like a main actress role. But yeah, she did great. And the way that I interpreted that scene with her son, fantastic dialogue, fantastic acting. But when that, whatever he was, a white supremacist.
Yeah, it kind of seemed like that.
Something
yeah.
like that. But when he insulted him and he said something about his mother. I felt that was almost like, you know, it reminded me of like a cockfight where the two like chickens have to like chest up to each other. And like, I almost looked at it as, listen, I know that my mom is here, but I gotta go and I can't lose face here. I gotta go into defense mode
because
you know, only the strong survive in here. And this is part of my shtick and I can't ever look weak. And maybe that was just a prison thing. I mean, that was just one of my thoughts that I had.
Yeah, I can see that. That's definitely not that's
the extent he did, but you know.
Yeah, that's definitely not the way that I took it at first blush, but I can definitely see that, huh?
And maybe that's why he avoided the confrontation. I mean, you could definitely tell he grew, but remember, it was just that morning that he threatened his boss that, you know, he would hurt him if he wouldn't give him his job back.
Oh, so, yeah, because he's saying, you want me to go out? You want me to be out there selling drugs? Do you want me waiting for you when the store closes or something like that?
Yeah, he does say, I mean, that's some pretty harsh shit to say to somebody. You know, I mean, he's lucky that his old boss didn't call the cops. He's probably got a PO officer or something along those lines. He can't be risking that kind of behavior. But I did, you know, of course it's a redeeming thing, the idea that he tries to get away. But as much of police brutality as this is, and it was, I mean, the horrible injustice that this young man suffered, for being in the wrong place at the wrong time dealing with asshole cops.
Yeah.
But he's never in that position if he doesn't have a record, you know?
Mm.
He only knew those hoodlums on the train because of his time in prison.
Sure.
And in order to get into prison, he did something pretty bad, you know? And yeah. So, you know, when you live a lifestyle that's one of danger, I mean, it's tough because he is the victim here and he is completely treated at the end of his life with, you know, absolutely no kindness, no respect, and they take everything from him. His life, you know, the idea that he's a father who's now not going to watch his daughter grow up, all because of an overreaction from police officers. And, you know, we see it time and again, and the one thing that I do want to take away from this is, even though that a film like this can take the easy route to just look at how the cops are the bad guys, I think it's also incumbent upon the director to tell the whole story, to show him as flawed as he was, and the idea that he, you know, he was still a pretty violent person with violent tendencies.
Sure. What do you make
that side too?
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that he seems to be stopping the drug selling? I saw that and I'm kind of like, it was almost like the dog thing to me, to where I was like, okay, well, I get it, but what are you blowing all of this potential money for?
Right, right.
You know, that's kind of like, especially like, he found out he didn't, I don't know, like, if he would have gone to the coast, dumped out all of the weed, then go to try to get his job back, and then that's why he's sort of blowing a fuse, because it's like, look, I just blew my only way to get money.
Yeah.
And now what am I going to do? Kind of like a panic almost.
Right.
To where instead it's like, I understand that he doesn't get his job, but then he goes and dumps out his other revenue source.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, and I understand why he's doing it. You know, he's trying to be a better person and you know, he's trying to turn the corner and all that. Like, I get that, but just like, you know, logically, I'm like, oh, what are you doing? You're making a really bad choice here. Like,
yeah, they got rent to pay, you know?
Yeah, this Asian guy was all about it. Like, just, you know, give him, put it on him.
Yeah.
It's like, look, just, I'm unloading all of this. I'll cut you a deal. What do you got on you? Kind of a thing. Not that I'm advocating selling drugs, but I'm just saying for his situation. So, the next thing that I took a note of was, they go out, the mom tells them to take the train, don't drive, don't drink and drive.
Right.
They go and they are on their way home, I think, and they stop for the bathroom. And they convince a guy to let the girls use the bathroom.
Right.
And we have this scene where they're waiting for the bathroom and he's allowed this pregnant woman. He's kind of talked the guy into letting this pregnant woman go in there too. And he's talking to this white guy.
Yeah.
And the guy's kind of like, oh, well, you know, if you need anything, here's my card, and trying to make like a connection. And I don't know what really that's doing in there. Like, again, I really like the film. And so I hope it doesn't come off like I didn't enjoy it, but I don't understand really what the point of that was, whether it was just a, here's the progression of his day, and this is what happened next. And maybe this guy was like, yeah, I remember I talked to that guy and we sat outside this restaurant or this business and he let my wife use the restroom or, you know, whatever. If that was the situation, kind of like the dog that we had mentioned, but I don't know, like, narratively really what it adds, whether it's like he could be a good person outside of his position. Or what exactly that was trying to show, I guess.
And they did the same thing with the girl at the fish counter in the grocery store, because wasn't it her that he later saw in the train car where?
Yeah, that's what started the problem. Yeah,
a coincidental thing. Like, that's another thing I wonder about. Like, was she like a witness, and did she give some kind of testimony that said, I met, you know, him?
I think
that
she
morning.
Was the one that had the video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think she had to have been a real person.
Right.
But
maybe that came out that, it was a, you know, freak occurrence, but I just met him that morning and I happened to see him on the train. But it does seem like kind of a long shot because, you know, Oakland's a pretty big city. And,
sure.
You know, who knows? I mean, it's New Year's Eve.
Yeah. And I wonder about that scene that we were talking about because, you know, where he's doing the fish fry stuff and he calls his grandma and you get that kind of, oh, lordy, kind of thing. Like, this white girl doesn't even know how to fry fish, you know, and that, and you're like, eh, okay, whatever. And, you know, that was like, oh, this is definitely setting up something. And I had seen the trailer, so I knew, she, you know, because she's like, Oscar or whatever. And I was like, oh, damn, that's where he meets the girl that gets him in trouble later.
Yeah.
And so that was a little bit of coincidence to where I was like, okay, well, it's just kind of for the film, or maybe that's how it really happened. Who knows? But yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what to make of that whole bathroom sequence. And Right. I did like that it was kind of a quiet moment before the sort of
storm, yeah.
Yeah, before the storm here. And
yeah, because you knew it was coming.
Sure.
I told myself that I didn't want to look up any facts about the actual case while the movie was going on. Uh-huh. And I made it till about three quarters through the movie, and I couldn't help myself. And I dialed it up on Wikipedia because I just wanted to know more about, you know, the asshole who shot him.
And, sure.
You know, what ended up happening with him. I mean, did you end up doing any of that?
No, I didn't look it up. I didn't look it up at all. I was like, just trying to go from what the film presented to me. And again, I guess I should say I watched this last night, so
yeah,
it hasn't been.
And I watched it about 3 weeks ago, so sure. I mean, it's not as fresh as it is for you. But I feel bad repeating what I think I remember because I might have it wrong. But
no, I think you're right on so far.
The guy who pulled the trigger and shot the guy, his testimony said, "I thought I was reaching for my taser."
Yes.
"And I grabbed my gun instead."
Right.
"And, you know, and it was an accident and I didn't mean to do it." And from what I remember, he either was kind of like force resigned or resigned within a month of the incident. So he's not a cop anymore. And I want to say that he did serve some prison time.
Yeah, it was in the film it says it was 11 months.
Yeah, 11 months he served. And then I want to say there may have been some kind of a civil suit that was filed. And
yes.
And the family got some money from it. But, you know, I don't think it was any more than $1 million, if that.
Yeah, I don't know the specific figures either. I know that Oscar's father, who is in jail for murder, also has the opportunity to sue them.
Uh-huh.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, he's in jail for murder, but yet he can sue and reach a settlement and while he's, you know, clearly didn't have anything to do with anything.
Right, right.
But yeah, so let's get into this end, and it's, you know, they're on the way back and from downtown or wherever they were, and they're on the train and he sees this girl because he's tired and he's wanting to sit down, and he goes away from his girlfriend. And we haven't really talked about the girlfriend. I think she's great. She's you know, it's Melanie Diaz is the actress, and I think that
yeah, I've seen her in something before.
Yeah, she's very real feeling. Yeah. You know, and I really like that, to where she's not like pencil thin. You know, right. she looks like a real person, and I really right. appreciate that. And so we have you know, this other girl recognizes Oscar, and then the sort of white supremacist that we're calling him from the prison happened to be there as well. And then they start fighting a little bit and the police gets called and the friends of his kind of scatter and Oscar stays in the train and then gets pulled out by, Kevin Durand is the actor who, coincidentally was on Lost that, fellow Chicagoan Sean Stenglen and I have been talking about. And he was a player in that show. And so he here as the main asshole cop, I was like, oh, I completely believe this. Cause like, this is this man's lane and he is staying in it. But he's being a jerk and saying all kinds of names to him. And this is when for the first time in the film, Oscar shows a little bit of, like hesitancy or, you know, he doesn't fly off the handle. He actually shows a little bit of, whoa, let's, you know, because he's like, oh, it's good. We're good. You know, and just kind of like everyone calm down. Everything's going to be fine. And everything's fine. And then if we don't get the main asshole cop. We don't get Kevin Durand or Durand, however you say it. We don't get him. He's not the one who actually shoots him. It's this other guy that doesn't really get any screen time, that doesn't really have, you know, there's no story.
Yeah, he wasn't one of the original officers on the scene. He was one of the later ones to arrive.
Yeah, and he's, you know, the Oscar's got a knee in his face, I believe. And, you know, I love that it's not this long, drawn-out sequence. There's not this dialogue back and forth, and there's not, like, a racial slurs being thrown around, and then one of them puffs out his chest and then gets shot or something. I'm so glad that it wasn't right. like that. It was just a decision was made. He shot and everyone's like, oh, like, you know, and then quiet. And it was on the opening footage of the film too, because it's like, holy shit. Like, yeah. You know, we just thought this was like maybe he's going to get beat up a little bit or, mm-hmm. you know, this is bullshit that even that's happening. But for him to be shot.
Right.
Even watching it, I was just like, holy shit. Like, I was just surprised at the way that it happened.
Yeah.
And so I thought that that was particularly good. I did see that in the IMDb trivia that they filmed that at the actual location of the event.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that Michael B. Jordan did, like, fall right where the bullet is, like where the hole is.
Yeah.
And so that's like right on the spot. And I was like, wow, like what a hard place to be in as an actor. Like, how could you not feel the moment? You know?
Well, it sounds like that particular area is treated pretty sacredly because it looks like they have some kind of an annual memoriam or some kind of event that they do every year because it kind of ended the film that way with one of the, warm balloons released in the air or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it has his actual daughter.
Yeah.
As the film closes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's having a memorial, yeah. One of the other things that I really like is, you know, we get the rushing him to a hospital and the mother being there and the mother getting the call from the girlfriend and, you know, that kind of hysteria. And a lot of it is... A lot of it can be eye-rolling or can be like, okay, well, you know, we've seen this how many times in any film where mm-hmm. there's a gunshot. You know, we have this sort of sequence. But I thought that, again, Octavia Spencer was so good with her. It's her fault because she said to take the train.
Right.
You know, and just the not like hysterical, stereotypical sort of performance. It was just kind of like she felt like she had let her son down to mm-hmm. where it's almost like, you know, I should have known better. I should right. have known that this was a situation that he didn't need to be in.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought that she was particularly good in that sequence.
Yeah. Her performance was just as strong at the hospital and, where she's kind of, the one where all the information is directed toward on, you know, what kind of situation he's in, critical, sure. you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. So she did real well there too.
Yeah. And then we have the final filmed sequence is, you know, something that no one would ever want to have to do where it's, you know, the girlfriend has to go pick up the little girl
mm-hmm.
and we just see her and the two of them in the shower. And yeah. I love the choice of not saying it.
Yeah.
The little girl just says, "Where's daddy?" And she just kind of looks at her and the little girl looks at her and like, I don't know if I'm putting it on the film, but I felt like she sort of either nodded or you could see that there was some sort of acceptance mm-hmm. of she didn't have to say he was shot. She didn't have to spell it out. The girl knew.
Yeah.
And that's tough. Like that was a really heartbreaking sequence. For me, you know, living with a 5-year-old little girl now. And so that was something where I was like, holy shit. Like yeah. that's something that, you know, obviously no one wants to go through that, but that's something that, given the circumstances, something that hit me particularly hard.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a pretty powerful scene right there.
Yeah. So I thought that was really good. What do you think of the facts about the end? You know, the 11 months for the officer that shot him. You know, do you think that without getting into like real into social issues, do you think that that should have been more since he was a cop, or do you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Buy that he, you know, doesn't like shouldn't he be more responsible and like be punished more? You know, because he's supposed to be upholding the law and protecting people, not killing them. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think he got away with murder mm-hmm. quite frankly. So 11 months is not justice for, what he took away. And, especially considering the film, the context, what was going on, it was complete and total police brutality. I know some police officers, I'm friends with a lot of them, and I have so much respect for, you know, people like firefighters and first responders and police officers, whether they're university police or they're subway police, you know, they're the ones that put themselves in harm's way. So, I mean, respect them more I could not do. But, the situation that we saw on that film, was an example of the very few bad apples who use their power as an abusive power. And I'm not saying he intended to kill him, but he was being completely, as somebody who was already restrained, why you would even tase somebody who's restrained is beyond the point, number one.
Yes.
And number two, if the bullet didn't hit him, there's a chance that guy, I believe his knee was on his neck.
Or, yes.
I mean, he was being smashed into a cement block like that. I mean, he could have been killed that way too. I mean, it was just complete police brutality.
Yeah. What is interesting is that actor is, Chad Michael Murray. And Chad Michael Murray, he's best known from One Tree Hill, House of Wax, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
But he is, he's kind of like your, in One Tree Hill, which was a WB show, he's kind of like your main heartthrob person that you're following.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, for him to have such a small role, but yet ultimately a important role, I mean, that was really surprising to me, and I didn't necessarily recognize him. I was like, oh, I sort of know who that guy is. His hair's different than what I recall, but, my little sister watched the hell out of some One Tree Hill, so I was like, I definitely know who this guy is.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just kind of weird for an actor who at one point I think was, you know, supposed to be at least sort of an up-and-comer to take on a role such as this and a dramatic role. Before we kind of wrap up though, Steve, what do you think about if this was something, you know, a little bit opposite? Like, what if this was Midwest and it's a white kid who was shot by a black officer? You think that's still an 11-month situation?
Most likely not.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we can get into the politics all you want. I mean, I'm sure you see my Facebook feed. I follow this kind of stuff pretty closely. and the fact that just in Florida, a guy can shoot into a car. He emptied his clip. I believe he fired 14 bullets and he killed a 17-year-old kid over a dispute on loud music.
Mm.
And this guy gets acquitted of first-degree murder is, you know, it's just another example of how if it was completely the opposite, if it was black people shooting into a car with white people in it, those guys would have been hung out to dry in the first, you know, means of capital punishment, especially down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a very extreme rate of capital punishment. I believe they even put to death a woman recently, if I'm not mistaken. So, this is an example of how, you know, it's not 1964 anymore, but, you know, you can see the racism.
Yeah, sometimes things aren't as different as we'd like them to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different kind of racism now. And I really think that white people get frustrated because they feel like they're sick of hearing about it. I don't ever want to take for granted that which I know nothing about, and I don't know what it's like to be black and walk into a store and be followed.
Sure.
I don't know what it's like to be black and driving in the middle of the night and getting pulled over, because that doesn't happen to me.
Right.
So I always try to empathize with all kinds of people, you know, whether it's minorities or whether it's women or, you know, anybody. And, I think that, just because, you know, people at my Thanksgiving dinner table are sick of hearing about black people complain about racism just because they've been hearing about it their whole lives, doesn't give it any less validation that it still exists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's one of those where it's like, this film is a story about a young black man who was killed, and haven't we seen that?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we have, but not every circumstance is the same. And I think that it's a story that was, you know, definitely worth telling. And I was really glad that you decided to pick this one, because there was, I know that when I got a hold of you, there was a laundry list of films that you'd been watching that, you're like, well, what about this? How about this? Have you seen this one? And I was like, fuck, I haven't seen any of these. Like, I haven't seen any of these, Steve. Like, you pick one. We'll do it. So I was really happy with this one.
Yeah. I'm glad I told you this one, too, because there's plenty to talk about. And I thought it was really well done. I really liked it. I know on I'm just looking at IMDb. It didn't get as good of ratings, but I don't think it's for lack of good acting. It was good storytelling, and I just thought it was well done.
Yeah, it was a little surprising in the – I think it's like a 7.5 or so.
Yeah, something like
that's,
that.
That's surprisingly low for
yeah,
me.
I thought it would be a little bit better. And a lot of these kind of indie-type caliber films don't get – the kind of pub that they, you know, oftentimes deserve. You know, you don't have much star power in this film, but it's a very powerful story, and it's a story that I'm glad I know about, because if they didn't make a movie about it, I wouldn't have ever heard about it, you know?
That's right. You know, it is, as much of a tragedy as it is, it sadly happens more often than we can keep up with.
Right.
You know, like you were saying before we started discussing it, really, was that you watch a lot of news and teach journalism, but this was a film, or this was a story that flew under your radar. So,
and I just happened to watch 60 Minutes tonight, and it was about a neo-Nazi guy who got shot by his own son, and his son was 10 years old. And I totally remember that when I read it. Like, I remember it was a couple few years ago, and I remember, like, wow, a white supremacist got shot by his own son. Must be a real stable household or something. I remember thinking that to myself, and then boom, 2 years later, you get like the aftermath of one of this 10-year-old is serving a 10-year sentence, and you know what's going on with the wife and other things like that. You know, and it's like that one I remember, but I would have never have known about Fruitvale Station if it wasn't for this film. So
yeah, gotta get those damn guns out of people's hands, right, Steve?
Well, we gotta get them out of the crazy people's hands.
Or that's, you could go we recently watched Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker.
Oh yeah, I love that.
Again, and he's talking about
control, right?
Yeah, he's talking about the guns aren't the problem, it's the bullets are the problem. We need bullet control. I'd make bullets $5,000.
And then he says something about like, well, he must have done something wrong. He put $50,000 worth of bullets in his ass.
That's exactly right, yeah. Yeah, so that's good. So I like that, yeah. Well, do you have anything else about Fruitvale before we wrap this baby up?
Well, I just want to say that it's definitely worth a spin on Netflix. I don't think it's streaming, unfortunately, so you'd have to get it through the mail unless they change their offerings. But it's only 85 minutes. It's a good view. I was really not entertained, but engaged, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
And again, it's nice to learn about things that happen, and it's just nice to know that, you know, things like this don't go unnoticed. And it's films like these that I think help shape, you know, social discussion and try to, you know, take ourselves to the next level, to a society that doesn't have to deal with tragedies like this, you know.
Yeah, it's nice, you know. I like a movie as much as the next guy, but this is more of a film.
Yes.
You know, and for me, like, a movie is like your Avengers, your Transformers, like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
To where it's more escapist. And this is more of a film where, like you're saying, it's more social issues. It's more discussion based. Mm-hmm. It's more, you know, true to life and that sort of thing. So wrapping us up, if you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter. I am at EricWilliams79. The show is at Plain Label Pod. We also have a Facebook page where you could like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. Just like our regular show, we do have Amazon links on our website, plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. If you click on the link and buy Fruitvale Station, we do get some of that money, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. And since you're already over on our site, we have an Amazon box over there, just below where the movies are located. If you click on that Amazon box, it takes you to their homepage. And what I want you to do is bookmark that homepage and then use that whenever you buy anything from Amazon. And what it does is it gives us a little bit of that money. It doesn't change anything for you. It just helps us in a little bit in paying the bills and that sort of thing. So I do want to thank Steve once again for coming on and discussing the film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they do so?
Well, I'm primarily a Facebook user, so
Twitterless Steve.
Twitter. Well, the thing is I did open up a Twitter account. It's not really, I don't think I've checked it in a while because I just can't really get into it. But my handle is SteveBrun77.
Oh, there you go. Staying with that that full name and date of birth, or that year of birth.
Yeah,
that seems to be clutch.
That's what I went with. Yeah, so you know that I'm a 37-year-old guy named Steve Bruns. It's not Burns, it's Bruns.
That's right. And they could find you over on Facebook if they wanted to.
Right. Well. You can also email me at Seinfeld4. That's SeinfeldFore at yahoo.com.
There you go. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
Trying to get rid of these ghosts that's cursing me. I feel a change is an absolute certainty.